From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Busy show ahead of us tonight. There's an organization in the United States that's very upset with Attorney General Eric Holder. Larry Pratt is the Executive Director of the Gun Owners of America. You can click on the link in the show notes to get to their webpage. And that organization is saying Eric Holder is waging one of the worst abuses of power in history. Here's Larry. All right, we're back. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. My name's Dana Pretzer. Larry Pratt is the Executive Director of the Gun Owners of America. It's been a while since we've had Larry on the show. Always nice to have him. Larry, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Now, Eric Holder, we could do a two-hour show on Eric Holder and probably keep going, but an interesting statement from you. Holder is waging one of the worst abuses of power in history. Of course, we've heard lots about Eric Holder and the Michael Brown shooting incident, and he seems to get involved with trying to discredit law enforcement, in my opinion. What's yours?
Well, has made some very strong statements and very critical of the Ferguson Police Department in particular, and implied that they were a bunch of racists. And happily, they were called out by Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who himself is an African American, and said that was insulting to all police, and Eric Holder needs to apologize to all police. This guy is evidently very, very anti-police. It's not just Ferguson that has him irritated. I don't know what kind of anarchy he's prepared to live in, but he certainly doesn't seem to want to have cops around.
Well, it's a political opportunism, race baiting, whatever you want to call it. Once you get Eric Holder, Barack Obama, Jesse Jackson, and Al Sharpton involved, it's never going to go well. But as the executive director of the Gun Owners of America, you'll take some criticism, and I know you have in the media. You'll take some praise in the media. But when we look at the big picture in Ferguson or other law enforcement agencies across the United States, this isn't the same world that we lived in even 5 years ago. It's getting tougher to be a cop out there.
It is. And the what happened to the police officer in Ferguson, I think, underscores that. From everything that we can learn from that situation, the cop was the victim. He was not only set upon by, I've forgotten the chap's name, Michael Brown, but he had a friend along with him, and apparently both of them were wailing on the cop while he was in the car. They finally somebody realized that there had been a bracelet on the companion's wrist, and at the scene of the crime, right outside the cop's door, the bracelet turned up on the ground. So pretty strong indication that they were both working him over, and just underscores the fact that that was a self-defense shooting. I mean, you got a broken eye bone. That's a pretty good indication that you weren't doing real well in the encounter. So this is and to try to use that to inflame race relations around the country and to make cops the target of that racial hatred is just despicable.
Larry Pratt's here. He's the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. Now, they're talking about civil rights investigations and all this sort of stuff. We can go back to the White House and their beer summit a few years ago. And really, when it comes down to law enforcement and the Obama White House, your thoughts on what the relationship has been?
Well, it's been very, I think, improper. The White House sends out signals every once in a while. You mentioned the beer summit. That was after Obama had insulted a cop who was concerned about a guy he didn't know entering a house. Turned out to be a black guy in a white neighborhood. But that was the big cause celeb of that day. And these guys just seem to be race hustlers. They're sort of like having Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton in office. It doesn't work out well.
No, for sure. And when we look at the media coverage now, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, you name it, around the world, from your perspective as the executive director of the Gun Owners of America, critique the media coverage of this case.
Well, I think Fox was probably pretty even-handed, but particularly MSNBC, which is an arm of the Democrat Party, was just all in for trying to keep this thing going, to make it a big deal and hopefully a national uproar. That race is what passes for an argument on the left. You've probably experienced it. Most of us on the right probably have, that when you're in a discussion with somebody on the left and you pretty well nail down your case and get his on its back, as it were, you're a racist. And that'll be the parting shot. And so it's kind of confirmation that end of argument, you just won.
Yeah. Now let's take it from cable media or cable news and mainstream news to now social media, the internet, and everything that's there, much bigger than what it used to be 5 years ago. What about how social media has been covering this story?
I believe it was social media that substantially made the difference in the outcome of public opinion shifting back to a I want to know more. That there, when the autopsy was published and the social media made that known, all the bullets in Brown had come from the front. He had not been shot in the back, as his friend initially said. By the way, the friend has recanted his version of Brown being shot in the back, so now all 13 witnesses are saying the same story. And my view is that this is now going to be viewed as something that's not of interest anymore. The media's given up. They can't use this, so they just have to wait for another opportunity. But your point, I think, is an excellent one, that it's the internet, the various social media, that put the kibosh on what the media was trying to do.
You know, we've heard a lot about the Obama White House and the criticism of law enforcement agencies being supplied, so to speak, with military equipment. Again, this is not the same world that it was even 5 years ago. What about that and your thoughts from the GOA?
That's a matter of concern. And while I think the police officer handled himself properly, he was acting in self-defense, the department, the police chief, decision to deploy a fully militarized group of cops when there were peaceful, unarmed protesters in Ferguson, I think indicates that we've militarized the police, and they want to bring out that militarization whenever they have the slightest opportunity, and there's no notion of equivalence. I can give you an example of just how radically police thinking has changed. I was in the Virginia legislature a long time ago, and a friend had set me up with an opportunity to ride around with a cop for a morning. And I think it was around 10 o'clock, we pulled up to a nice suburban home, and the cop got out and said, you just stay there in the front seat. And he went on up to the house, knocked two or three times. Finally, young man, obviously had just gotten up, came to the door, cop said a few words, and went inside. About 5-10 minutes later, the young man came out, hands behind his back, handcuffed. Cop put him in the car and took him into the station. I went in with him, and the kid was booked on drug charges. Now, today, that same scenario could easily have been a full-blown SWAT raid.
Right.
And somebody might have gotten killed.
Yeah, it's different. It's different, but some will argue that because of the accessibility to firearms, Larry, that's why the law enforcement is having these problems. And if we had more gun control, then those problems wouldn't exist. Your thoughts?
We had as much access to guns, if not more, 40 years ago when the episode I'm telling you about occurred, than we do today. We had fewer gun control laws on the books. So I know the view you're referring to is shared by many people, but it's just not correct.
Mass shootings, situations where law enforcement are involved. We have an incident where a white storekeeper was beaten by a group of black teenagers here just the other day, but the media is not grabbing a hold of that. Where's Eric Holder in that case?
Right.
What about the people? What about Joe and Mary Sixpack out there watching this and wondering about this government and how they react to these sorts of crimes?
Well, it's pretty evident that there's not going to be any response to black-on-white crime. And hopefully the takeaway is, folks, get a gun, because it just may not be that the police are going to be there when you need them. And even if they could get there, they may not get there in time. If they got there in 5 minutes, which would be a very good response time, you could be dead several times over.
The people raise their eyebrows a little bit about, Larry, is when we see the stories, and again, we all know the media is slanted when it comes to reporting, the 9 or the 10-year-old little girl, I forget what it was now, with the automatic weapon and the firing range and the instructor being killed. What about that? How do you counter that from the GOA?
Well, that's happened a total of once before. It's a very, very rare occurrence. So to take any conclusion away from that, I think, is really not a good idea. That just almost never happens. And so what should be done? Nothing.
Eric Holder, and again, waging one of the worst abuses of power in history. You and I both know, Larry, that it may not be tomorrow or the next day, but it could be next week. There'll be another story, another place, another officer, another shooting, another whatever. And the government will jump in. There will be civil rights. There'll be race baiting. There'll be whatever. What do you say as the executive director of the GOA to the people that are listening to the show and others out there about how they should react when they hear these stories?
Well, they should probably just make sure that their firearms are in good working order and they have plenty of ammunition. I don't think really, though, that the drive for gun control, which is what this is all about, is going to be successful. The American people, it seems to me, increasingly understand that we're on our own for our own protection. And try as they might, the police just are not going to, they certainly can't be our personal security. They're not our bodyguards. They're not with us 24/7. And as the police chief, the sheriff of Milwaukee County, David Clark, said the other day, I wouldn't want my cops, I wouldn't want so many cops that they were around everybody 24/7. That's called a police state, and that's not tolerable. So if we're going to think in the real world, we've got to be prepared to defend ourselves. And that's only proper. You don't want so many police that they could actually presume to protect you. Because if we have that many police, I'm afraid we're talking about a police state.
Last question. Funding for law enforcement across North America. A lot of cities, municipalities, states, federal governments are trying to run protective services like businesses. They want a line item, so it looks like they're making money on fines, but they're not paying that much money for salary. How do we get men and women across North America to sign up for a job that really doesn't have a lot of thanks to it?
Well, that's a good point, and those that do, I think, by and large, are certainly public service-minded people. I know that Sheriff Clark, that I've had the pleasure of getting acquainted with, and in fact I've had him as a guest on my weekly show, he's the kind of guy you'd want to have living next door. He's just such a wonderful guy, solid guy, and that's what he expects out of his officers. And I kind of think that's the way most of the cops are.
Larry Pratt is the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. Click on the link in the show notes to go to that webpage. Always a pleasure, sir. Take care.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Larry Clark, the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. Now, anytime I have Larry on the show, I usually take some flack for it from the anti-gun crowd that's out there. Now, we try to show both perspectives here on the Dana Pretzer Show, pro-gun and anti-gun. Last show, we had some anti-gun people on, and now the pro-gun people are making their opinion. But what opinion is pretty consistent out there is that Eric Holder is waging one of the worst abuses of power in history. And we don't see a lot of him when it's a white person that has been injured or killed. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And did I say Larry Clark? Not Larry Clark, Larry Pratt. Larry Clark is a person that I know. Anyway, Larry Pratt is the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Dale Archer. Dale Archer is a psychiatrist, friend of the program, and with the recent death of Robin Williams, the topic of depression has come forward, and we're going to go right to one of the experts and talk about that. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Dale Archer is a medical doctor, a board-certified psychiatrist, and distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, a friend of the program. Always a pleasure to have him on the show, and we want to talk about issues of mental health. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
I'm good, and good to be here, Dana.
Now, I understand, just talking off air with you a little bit, that second book is done. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Second book is done as of about an hour ago. The name of the book is called The ADHD Advantage, What You Thought Was a Diagnosis Could Be Your Greatest Strength. And it's essentially taking a chapter from the first book, Better Than Normal, which looked at 8 psychiatric diagnoses and talked about some of the good aspects of each of those, and took the ADHD trait. And I'm looking at all of the various good aspects of this condition, which no one really talks about. The fact that these people are more resilient than average, that they're better multitaskers, that they're more creative, that they have great nonlinear thinking, that they're very intuitive, that they are risk takers and will follow a lead when in their gut at the appropriate times. And so that they're 3 times more likely to found their own business and be an entrepreneur. So everyone knows that, yeah, there are some downsides to having the ADHD condition, but unfortunately it's overdiagnosed, it's over-medicated, and the condition should be ranked along a continuum from 1 to 10, and those at the 9 or the 10 or the 10-plus level may need treatment, may need medication, but unfortunately in today's diagnostic world, we're lumping those in the 5 to 8 range in there with the 9s and the 10s, and we're medicating all of them.
Dr. Dale Archer's here, New York Times bestseller. So when I have you on the show again, I'll be able to say New York Times bestseller again.
I hope so.
Listen, in all seriousness, it's always a big kick to have you on the program, but something that we need to talk about, sadly, with the passing of Robin Williams, something that we don't hear enough about and discuss enough, in my opinion, in the media, is depression. Now, it shouldn't have to take the death of a famous person to bring this up again, but I wanted to bring you on to talk about depression and just how deadly it is.
Well, of course, it is a deadly condition, and of course, what most people don't realize is that the number one predictor of those who commit suicide is a clinical diagnosis of depression. Not only that, these people, in the overwhelming majority, have seen a medical practitioner within the last 3 months. So what that means is they're reaching out for help in some way, shape, or form, and we as the medical profession are failing them because we are not recognizing this condition for what it is. But It's a tragedy with Robin Williams, and unfortunately sometimes it takes a tragedy like that in order to focus the attention of the world on the fact that, wow, this guy had it all. How in the world could he be depressed? And how could he be so depressed that he would take his own life?
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Archer, when we talk about comedians, and just all you have to do is Google recent deaths of comedians, and the suicide rate is high. What about that fact of you're funny on the outside, but you're torn apart on the inside?
Well, you know, I think that for comedians, it's a two-edged sword. And oftentimes, if you interview a comedian, I mean, for my book, actually, I had the great pleasure of interviewing Howie Mandel, and really gave a lot of insight into how insecure he is on the inside, whereas to the world, it looks like he's outrageous and crazy and funny. And it's almost like the use of humor to garner attention and get other people to laugh is their defense mechanism that is covering up a very insecure nature. And I think that that's very common with comedians, and probably was common with Robin Williams. And I think to make it even worse, it's harder for that type of person to reach out and get help. It's harder for them to say, you know, I'm the guy that makes everybody laugh, but really I'm depressed on the inside. So it's a two-edged sword.
Living up to an image is a difficult thing, but some of the other reports that we heard about Mr. Williams was a recent diagnosis of Parkinson's and maybe some other health issues that may have brought on the depression once again or stirred it up. What about that?
Well, certainly he had a long history of substance use and abuse, and the data is overwhelming there that when you do abuse drugs over a period of time, you're at greater risk for depression. Certainly a Parkinson's diagnosis is linked to depression as well. I think there's a psychological component to that because, in addition to the brain chemistry component, because I mean, clearly, if you read about it, you start realizing you're going to be facing drastic limitations in your life in terms of what you can do and how well you can move and on and on and on. So, you know, I think this was a guy that probably was predisposed in several different areas. But the saddest part is that this is a treatable condition. Depression is treatable. And for those out there that don't understand how someone could take their own life, I need to paint a quick picture for you. I need you to picture that you are feeling worse than you've ever felt in your life. You can't sleep. You have no energy. Nothing you do brings any type of joy to you. You're miserable. You feel anxious. You feel like the butterflies in your stomach, your heart is racing, you're sweating, you just feel absolutely horrible. And along with that, you start thinking, there's nothing I can do that will change this. You start feeling helpless, and then when you think you can't change it and you're helpless, then you become hopeless. And then at that point, when you've given up hope and say, I'm never going to get better, your brain starts to say, well, if I have to live the rest of my life like this, I'd be better off dead because I can't live like this. This is too painful. And that's when the thoughts of suicide come. And, of course, it's a vicious cycle when if you get a professional in there and can say, we can treat this. We can break this cycle. We can use therapy to show you where your thinking is flawed. If needed, we can use medication to correct brain chemical imbalance if that's there. Then these people can be saved. But so often, they just don't go in for treatment.
What about the stigma of being a person who admits that they have a mental issue or a mental health issue or denial? How about that? It's tough to be able to stand up and say, listen, I suffer from depression, and the public shunning that you may or may not get.
Well, I think there are two components there. So component number one is oftentimes it's hard to self-diagnose. So you may talk to these individuals as a non-professional and have very little insight into the fact that they're suffering from a clinical mental health condition. And they may have a little insight into that. they may think they feel bad because their life isn't going well, because they're nervous, they're high-strung, because they're not sleeping well, on and on and on, but they never may make the connection that, oh, this constellation of symptoms, this comprises a diagnosis. This is clinical depression, biologic depression, and I need to see someone. So they don't know. And on the other hand, if they do suspect, you're right. Even in today's modern world, there's no doubt that the stigma for psychiatric treatment is vastly decreased from when I started back in 1987, when it was hard to get anyone to come in the door to see a psychiatrist because the stigma was so overwhelming. Now, we've done a pretty good job overall in diminishing that, but cases where it often falls down are the rich, the powerful, the celebrity, the famous person. Those people, of course, have a tremendous ego and have a hard time admitting personal weakness, and therefore have a hard time admitting that they could actually have a condition. And sadly and unbelievably, they can think about suicide, but they can't think about going in to see a professional and getting help.
Some in the media were criticized when they would report on Robin Williams' death about their own personal thoughts. One national anchor was criticized because he said that Robin Williams took the coward's way out. It's interesting that when you have a celebrity as famous as Robin Williams, idolized as Robin Williams, that we're able to talk about mental health issues, but yet sit back and make fun of, so to speak, his addiction issues. Robin Williams didn't make fun of his addiction, I don't think, on the inside. He may have on the outside a little bit, but what about the media and how they cover stories like Robin Williams and mental health issues in whole?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, in a case like this, it becomes a feeding frenzy. And every media outlet on the planet is looking to put some content out there on this particular condition. And sadly, most of them are very uneducated in terms of mental health. They just don't get it. And I would strongly suggest that before you criticize anyone who considers suicide, that you walk in their shoes in terms of having a clinical major depressive disorder and see how you feel and see what your thoughts are at the time. So I can clearly understand, after seeing thousands of patients, how people think about suicide. That, to me, is not difficult to imagine. I've seen too many people in too much pain not to understand how they get to that point. It's not the coward's way out. Oftentimes, in their mind, it's the lesser of two evils. The sad part is we haven't done a good enough job in educating folks to say, yeah, these are the symptoms of depression. Thoughts of suicide is a symptom of depression. The number one predictor of someone who commits suicide is major depression. And interestingly, the number two predictor is alcohol and drug abuse. So if you have someone who has both of those, then of course it could be off the charts in terms of the possibility. Sadly though, of course, they can be treated. I just have to emphasize that over and over and over again. If you go in and you ask for help, that most of these cases can be saved and the suicide can be averted with therapy and sometimes medication.
One last question. Dr. Dale Archer is here. Click on the link in the show notes to go to his page, drdalearcher.com. What about when depression shows up? A young age, middle age, or is it any age where you might see the signs and symptoms, not only in friends or loved ones, but maybe yourself?
Well, you know, the classic age group was young to middle-aged adults. So 25 to 40 always was considered the classic risk age group, with women being about four times more likely than men to receive a diagnosis. Of course, our mindset on that now is not that there really are that many more women that have major depression. It's that women are more likely to go in and seek treatment and hence receive a diagnosis. But those statistics now are starting to skew a little bit. We're starting to see it across the whole age spectrum. I mean, I've seen it in kids that are in school, and I've seen it in geriatrics. In fact, it's becoming very, very common in the geriatric population. I think it's always been there. I just think that we haven't recognized it. And aside, in the geriatric population, when somebody starts declining like that, the immediate thought is, oh, they have dementia. They've got dementia, and that's understandable, and dementia can't be treated. So oftentimes, it's depression, and depression can be treated, and you treat that depression, and all of a sudden, the person who couldn't remember anything is functioning normally. So it is a age group, the whole lifespan group problem, you know, probably a little more common in middle age, but certainly now we're seeing it across the board.
Dr. Dale Archer is a New York Times bestselling author, psychiatrist, and a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and always a friend of the program. Thank you, sir. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Dana.
Okay.
I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Dale Archer. And you think about it, you know, nowadays, including my own family, there's a good chance that one of your loved ones or yourself may be suffering from depression, and it's something that you don't want to fool around with. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. And my thanks to Dale Archer. Always a pleasure to have him on the program. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with criminal profiler Pat Brown. Pat Brown is the author of several books, and, of course, an expert when it comes to criminal profiling. I want her thoughts on the ISIS terrorists and what she thinks about the shooting in Missouri and what's going on there. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute with criminal profiler Pat Brown here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. My next guest, Pat Brown, criminal profiler, the author of several books, The Murder of Cleopatra, How to Save Your Daughter's Life, Only the Truth, Profile of the Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, The Profiler, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths, and Killing for Sport, Inside the Lives of Serial Killers. She's always a friend of the program, and I want to talk to her about several different topics tonight. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Dana.
Nice to have you. It's been, what, a week since you've written a book? It's time to write another one, isn't it?
No, I've been kind of busy, so I have actually a couple in the plans, but yeah, I have to get around to them.
Exactly. And now, listen, a couple different topics we want to talk about tonight, but I want to start with the shooting in Missouri, Michael Brown, all the coverage that's been going on. You cover these cases. You watch these cases. You have an idea what's going on. What about it?
Well, the saddest thing, I get very frustrated with any of these kind of things like we saw down in Florida, is the politicizing of an incident. It is an incident. Incidents happen all over the country, all over the world, between people, a couple people. And oftentimes it's blown way out of proportion as to the meaning of it all. When maybe you just have two people who came in collision, could be one good person and one not so good person. It could be two not so good people. It could be people with some ideas that, you know, just at that moment in time, things happened. And we should be looking at it as an incident that needs to be properly analyzed and then properly adjudicated, and not something that we should bring in all the guns from all over the United States and every political who wants to make something out of it, you know, and hold their even going in there. I mean, it's like, really?
Yeah.
Is this necessary? And I don't think so. I think it's actually, I think it's destroying the actual just, you know, getting justice done in the situation as opposed to helping it.
Criminal profiler Pat Brown's here. And you mentioned Eric Holder. We talked about him earlier on in the show. And it seems like he shows up very critical of the police department there, talking about racism. The Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons show up in these cases.
Al will always show up. You know, he's gonna show up. We knew that one. You know, but 5 minutes into the thing.
What about the law enforcement officer too? He's a citizen.
Well, you know, that's the sad part about it. I mean, the quickly jumping to the racism thing really, really bothers me. And, you know, I come from a family that I have a daughter who is in law enforcement, has spent time on the street, you know, working just like that police officer. And I have kids, I have three children who are not white, who have never had a problem with law enforcement. So it isn't always just about white cop, black human being walking down the street, therefore if something happens, it is automatically racism. Because one of the things that people don't seem to understand is that when you're working in a neighborhood, because I've gone out on ride-alongs with my daughter, and she works a pretty, you know, when she was on the street, she's a detective now, but when she was on the street, she worked a pretty tough area of Prince George's County, Maryland, right on the D.C. borderline. And it's got a very high crime rate. And we spent most of our Friday and Saturday nights when I was with her racing from scene to scene. So we weren't sitting idle on the side of the road having a donut. You know, we were busy. Well, she was busy and I was busy watching her. But, you know, I was privy to getting to watch over and over and over how the police officers treated the citizens and the criminals. And I did not see racism going on. What I saw was actually sometimes I was amazed at how calm they stayed, how they often said, "Sir, sit down, sir. Please do not do that, sir. We're trying to work with you, sir." You know, because they're trying to keep control. A lot of times they know these guys too. Like, "Hey, you know, we picked you up last week. What are you doing here again this week?" "Oh, you know, I just messed up again." "Yeah, you did. Okay, yeah, I'm trying to help you out here." You know, because they actually know half of the people. So it's not like you're walking around, a white officer's walking around in an African-American community going, "I hate all these people. I'm going to get every one of them." I mean, these are people they deal with them day in and day out. And unless they have some kind of peculiar record, which is acknowledged that, "Wow, this guy is a racist dude." I mean, that can happen. But unless we have that, this may be just a police officer doing his job and being confronted with a situation, which certainly looked like a situation to me. And I would like to see that it properly be analyzed as to how this young man got shot, why he got shot, and, you know, and is the police officer in any wrong, or was he reacting to what was a self-defense situation when he was possibly being charged by a very large man, you know, when he shot at him, which is what you do when you get charged. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know because I'm not privy to all that information. I wish everybody would step back and let the proper course go through instead of throwing all kinds of, you know, allegations around, which are not necessarily so.
And that's exactly what I was going to bring up next. Pat Brown, Criminal Profilers here. The media and how they cover this story and the next one that we're going to talk about. The speculation is just dripping out there. The investigation itself isn't done, and now we see that the media have backed off a little bit now that some more information is coming out. So when we take a turn now, Pat, from Missouri, and we start talking about terrorism, ISIS in particular, and the beheadings of these journalists that we've been seeing broadcast all over the place, what are we doing right, or what are we doing wrong? Are we giving these terrorists their 15 minutes of fame that they're wanting?
Well, you know, these terrorists, some of them that were like ISIS and whoever's showing up in these videos, a lot of it's like a gang member, you know, they're a gang and they've got access to the media through basically YouTube. You know, it's wonderful methodologies these days to video whatever you want and chuck it up there. And it's very hard to stop. It is difficult to stop, you know, any of these beheading videos from showing up. I do think, you know, sad as it may be, and I may be taking a stand on this that some people aren't going to like, you know, I don't believe in dealing with terrorists. I don't. I believe the answer is we don't deal with you. And also the fact is we don't deal with you on your territory if our people go in your territory and get themselves in trouble. And I feel really bad for these journalists, but, you know, at some point, it's not our fight. We don't have to cover everything. We just don't. And if we're going to go into extremely dangerous zones where we have psychopathic gang kind of members who we call terrorists in that area of the world, you're going to expect some bad things are going to happen. You know, and I feel badly for them. I feel badly for the families, but you're taking a major risk. And you know it when you set foot there. And I don't think your government should necessarily back you when you take these risks. They should simply not respond to terrorism in those locations because it's giving that extra publicity when we go in and we barter with them and we go and we talk about it, you know, and day in and day out. It should be simply that's a sad situation that occurred in that country. The country must handle it. It's their crime, in a sense. You know, when you're in another country, I strongly believe this. When I go to another country, if I am a victim of a crime in that country, let's say, you know, we hear about rapes in India, which is overdone now because we have rapes in America, too. But I traveled to India, so I'll use that as an example. Let's say I go to India, and I decide to walk down some forlorn street at 3 in the morning, and I get gang raped by 5 dudes. Is that America's problem?
Yeah.
Do I think America should come in and save my butt because I was over in another country and put myself in a risky situation? You know, it's a sad thing I did that, but it's that country's, you know, it's the crime occurred in that country, and I have to depend on the justice of that country, the legal system of that country, to take care of it, their police to come in, do their investigation, and their legal system to handle it. I don't think America should get in there and have my back. Personally, I just don't think so. It's my decision if I want to leave this country and go into another one to depend on that country. So if somebody's going to run off to Syria and start running around in dangerous areas and get themselves kidnapped and harmed, I don't necessarily think America should go in there and have their back. I mean, I don't. And so I say a lot of people are going to agree with me, but I think that when we do that, we give a lot of ammunition to these kind of groups because they say, look, all we have to do is grab these people and we're going to have America paying attention. And that's what they want. So they're winning.
Pat Brown, Criminal Profilers here. One last question.
Sure.
When you see these stories, whether it's Missouri or whether you see the story of the terrorist or whether you see the next crime story that that you'll be looking at tomorrow, next week, or next year, or a case that you're working on, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What can we do better to have the people understand it? We're scaring them with the beheadings. We're inflaming them with the with the race baiting. What can we do to just tell them the story and let them make up their own mind?
Well, I think you pointed that right out there. We need to tell the facts. We need to stop making this a reality show. I mean, I was just frustrated this morning because I just read about they found the body of Holly Bobo down in Tennessee. She's a beautiful young singer who went missing quite a while back, and they have some people in custody who they have charged with her murder, although I have no clue what the evidence is. But this morning, they had found her body, and I'm reading the news reports, and it says her body was found near the home of the suspect. I'm like, really? Now, when I hear that, and I read that in about 20 different news articles, near the home of the suspect, I'm thinking, dang, you know, it's down the block. It's like 2 blocks from the suspect's home. That's interesting, right? It turns out that's not true. The body was found 10 miles away from the home of the suspect and about 10 miles away from the Bobo home. So I'm like, 10 miles away, that's a long distance. So, I mean, I hardly consider that near the home of the suspect. So somebody decided to take 10 miles instead of saying the body was found 10 miles from the Bobo home and 10 miles from the suspect's home, instead of just saying that and leaving it as it is. The commentary is, let's change that to near because now we want to ramp up that this guy's guilty. Well, you have no business ramping up with this guy's guilty because we have no clue. We don't know what the evidence is. We don't know a darn thing about this guy. He could be totally innocent. So why are you ramping up the thing that let's push it on him? You know, and it's different when we're talking about commentary in the sense that somebody said, what is your opinion on something? But when you have news reported as fact, it's near the home of the suspect, that's not a fact. You made that crap up, you know. And I think that's what I'm frustrated when I see a lot of media reports.
Yeah.
That we're not presenting facts, we're presenting commentary as fact.
So true, so true. Pat Brown, always a pleasure. Thank you, ma'am.
No, thank you, Dana.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's criminal profiler Pat Brown, and she always has an opinion, and that's why we love having her on the show. That's it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. We'll talk to you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.